lets bad things happen to us. It was in May of 1988. Julie Lindsay, a fine young Christian lady living in Montgomery, Alabama. Julie had been a student before at Troy University, and while down in Troy, Alabama, had been a church secretary. Had come to Montgomery to finish her education and start her professional career, and had two jobs as she worked her way through college. She worked a late shift at the Days Inn, Hope Hull, Alabama, just south of Montgomery, and one night a gentleman walked in and asked her if she had any vacancies. She said yes. He went back out to the car to get his buddy, came back in, and they said they wanted a non-smoking room. As she turned to look at the little chart they had there to decide which room to put them in, she noticed a movement out of the corner of her eye and turned, and there was a .22 caliber pistol pointed at the forehead. They came behind the counter, both of them, got all the money there was to get there, and then told her that they were taking her for a ride. They kidnapped Julie. They put her in the front seat of the car. As they drove down the interstate going south from Montgomery at a high rate of speed, she was praying, "Oh God, let there be a trooper who will see them speeding and stop them." There was no trooper who saw them. Nobody stopped them. The one in the back seat leaned over and began to put his hands down the front of her shirt, calling her vicious, filthy names in the process, then drug her over the seat. Now that she was in the back seat with him, he made her perform oral sex on him, calling her names, asking if she thought she was too good for that. She begged God that he would keep her from throwing up, thinking that if she did, that they would kill her. When he finished, he pushed her back over the seat. The one in the front seat then had her do the same to him while calling her names. Finally, they'd had enough. They stopped the car. The driver, the one with the gun, drug her over a fence into the woods next to the interstate, handcuffed her, and she realized she was about to die. She began to think about what it would feel like. And at this point, I actually look forward to it. She wanted to be dead. She did not want to endure any more pain at the hands of these two men. He then raped her. After raping her, he said, "I'll tell somebody where you are," and turned and walked away. Her entire body sagged in relief when she realized she was not going to die. And she lay there for, she doesn't know quite how long, until it dawned on her that obviously, he wasn't going to call anybody to tell where she was and that she needed to get away because he might change his mind and decided there need not be a witness. So she freed herself from the tree, got out to the interstate, 2 a.m. now, and she's trying to flag down cars and nobody would stop. She was bedraggled and bloody and torn, and people would just change lanes to get by her. Finally, a woman trucker stopped. Called for the troopers. They came, brought the other police, they took her to the hospital, had an examination done, confiscated all of her clothing for evidence, took her to the police station. She endured a barrage of questions in daylight. Her sister had come from Montgomery, and finally they let her go home. Rather than being the end of her nightmare, it was just the beginning. For the next several weeks, she has to answer all kinds of questions. The two men who had done this terrible deed to her were on a crime spree. They'd started in North Alabama and been going down the interstate. They already had hit Mobile by the next day and were over in the Mississippi. And she thought, well, when they finally catch them, at least I won't have to face them. And for some inexplicable reason, they turned and came back. It was in Montgomery where they were caught. And it was Julie who was chosen to testify against them. I sat with her just outside the room of the grand jury that was meeting to indict these men. She knew she would not have to see them that day, but was terrified that she'd have to look them in the eye again. And the two detectives said, "No, we've got so much evidence, there won't be a trial. They'll cop a plea." They did, and they're now serving in the Alabama State Prison at Atmore, Alabama. The first is eligible for parole in the year 2000, and the next in the year 2001. You say, "Joe, why in the world do you tell us a story like that?" Julie is a Christian. She loves God with all of her heart. She's done everything she can to obey Him in all the ways that she possibly can, and yet this terrible tragedy occurred in her life. Do you think she might be asking herself the question, why? I definitely would. I asked her, by the way, to recently write her answer to that. "Julie, how do you feel about all this now, and why God let those things happen to you?" And she wrote me back a page and a quarter that I received just the other day that's going into the book that Howard Publishing is publishing, Seeing the Unseen, to talk about what she understands now, all these years later, from that event that occurred in her life. Some of you guys have had to do things that you didn't want to do. When I was a young preacher, I recall the first person ever had to tell that a relative was dead. You remember how all that pain comes into your life when you have to tell these people these things, and you keep thinking, why God, why do you let it happen? You do know that God could stop Satan from doing anything, and God could stop Satan's angels if he so desired. We often pray for things like, "Oh God, camp your angels round about us. Protect us. Deliver us. Oh God, keep your spirit near. Oh God, please don't let any tragedy come." And yet we continually see that not only is there pain and agony in the world, there is pain and agony to those that follow Jesus, and that sometimes, no matter how diligently we have prayed, the tragedy occurs. You ever doubt God because of that? I'm sorry, I thought I asked you a question. How many of you ever doubted God? Wonder even if he were there. How many of you have been really angry with him? Wondering why in the world he let that occur? I have too. And I've spent my time trying to figure out what is the answer to all this? Why do these tragedies occur? Why does God let those evil beings do these things to us? I mean, I was flipping channels one time. How many of you guys are channel grazers? It's called channel surfing or channel grazing. Those are the technical terms for this. It's kind of a male gene. If you notice that, you can't help it. Right? By the way, in my corporate work, I do work for a lot of clients, including some of the bigger cable companies. TCI, for example, is one of my clients, largest cable company in America. I can tell you, by the way, so you might be prepared for this, within the next 3 years, every cable system in America, or almost every cable system in America, will have available to it 500 channels. I figured it out. It'll take 43 minutes to see what's on. You guys who are in marriage counseling need to prepare for the onslaught. I was flipping channels in this hotel room one Sunday morning just before I went to speak for a church somewhere. I can't remember exactly which city I was in, but I always get up to see what the local preachers are talking about on the tube. I like to do that. And as I was flipping channels, it was a guy preaching absolutely false doctrine. It was heresy from beginning to end. You say, "Wait, do you actually know a false teacher when you see one?" Well, most people don't, but I think I do. I know this guy was preaching false doctrine because he said, "Once you become a child of God, once you commit yourself to Jesus, nothing bad will ever happen to you again." And that's false doctrine. When I lived in Montgomery, Alabama several years ago, when I was still in ministry, you know, being a full-time preacher like some of you people are, a young lady, 12 years old, called a radio station one night to ask me a question. She said, "Have you read about the young girl in our community that was abducted by her 16-year-old neighbor, drug out into the woods, repeatedly raped, and then strangled to death?" Yeah, who hadn't heard about it? It'd been in the news, on the television, on the radio, on the newspaper. She said she was my best friend. We went to church together, and our Sunday school teacher told us if we just loved Jesus and went to Sunday school, God wouldn't let anything bad happen to us. My friend loved Jesus, and she went to Sunday school. Can you tell me why this happened? What are you going to tell this 12-year-old? Well, first of all, your teacher's a liar. I don't know if the teacher meant to be, but she was. And if we get the false implication to people that when they become children of God, that they are then protected to the point that no pain can come, we have taught them a false doctrine that leaves them totally unprepared for the onslaught, because I can guarantee you that no good deed goes unpunished. I can't give you a book, chapter, and verse for that, but I think it's a biblical principle. I'm quite convinced that when you do good things, it attracts the attention of bad beings, and these bad beings have tremendous power. If you were in the class yesterday, we showed you some of the examples in the Bible to show that they can control nature. They can be wind or fire. Not just use wind and fire, they can be wind and fire. They can be tornadoes. They can be lightning. Angels can do that, have the power to do that. And without getting into any of the debate about whether or not we believe that miracles occur, without even touching that, I'm saying that if you're using nature, there is no miracle involved at all. Right? You ever watch the news and see how erratic those tornadoes are? Did you see what happened in Alabama just last week? When that tornado touched down on that Methodist church and killed all those people? Did you happen to see on CNN the interview with the woman who was the pastor of that church? She stood there with her eyes blackened, her face swelled. She'd been hit by one of the walls that fell. She, too, lost a child in that, her 4-year-old, who'd been trained just that week what to do when a tornado came, to get on her knees and put her hands over her head and protect herself the best she could. And when the windows began to pop in that building, she did it. Just what she was trained to do. But the wall fell on her and she was crushed to death. You look at those things and say, "Wow, are all these just random acts of nature?" My response is, they may be. But there's also a possibility that they're angelic activity. And that some of these beings do what they do because not only do they enjoy hurting you, they want to do everything they can to get you to abandon God, to let go of Him, to walk away. And when you start getting angry with God and doubting God, at least that possibility occurs, does it not? How do you think God reacts when you get mad at Him? Do you think God looks down from heaven saying, "Who are you? And how dare you be angry with me? As a matter of fact, I think I'll just come down there and whoop up on you." Assuming he uses southern lingo. I can show you in the scriptures how John reacts. The story's in John 11. You remember the story, don't you? Lazarus was dying and Jesus was sent for, but he didn't go. And the reason he didn't go, obviously, was so that Lazarus would die. And finally, Lazarus is dead, and he starts out over there to go heal him. And the two sisters have been talking about it. You remember the sisters, Mary and Martha. Mary is the one that had anointed Jesus' feet with the oil after she washed them with the tears. You remember Mary from Luke 7, right? And as she gets to there, remember that Martha's the first one out, and Martha comes out to see him, and she said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Remember that? She's chastising him. She's saying, "It's your fault. You weren't here. He's dead. What are you going to do about it?" And do you remember what he said in John chapter 11 when he looked at her and he said, "You question me one more time and I'll zap you straight into hell." You remember that? What translation do y'all read? I have to be careful. I went speaking just outside of Mobile several years ago, and it was back when we used to have protracted gospel meetings. You guys remember that? You're over 40 if you do, right? Way to go, like Sunday through Friday. It used to be longer than that, like Sunday through like 2 or 3 weeks. But this was a Sunday through Friday. All young people are saying, "Are you kidding? Y'all actually went to church 70 nights in a row?" Yeah, and we had to get up and change the channels by ourselves on the TV. It was a crude time. But I was speaking to one of those protracted gospel meetings, and a lady came the first night who taught back to the preacher. That was the custom when she went to church. She had a pencil and a piece of paper, a pad, actually, and everything I said. She said, "Mm-hmm, that's right," and she'd write it down. Well, not being used to that, that kind of threw me. As fast as I talked, that just kind of tripped me up. And so I finally got to where I was paying attention to her. I'd say something and look at her. Finally got into sync with her and forgot her. You know, just forgot she was there. Got so used to her. It was kind of neat, actually, having somebody act like they were alive. And so... right? I finally forgot she was there, and I began to make an illustration, and I said, "Remember the time that the storm came up and tossed the ship, and Jesus was asleep below, and the disciples came down and wakened him and said, 'Lord, we perish,' and he said, 'Oh, you of great faith, to wake me to stop this storm.' Remember that?" And she said, "Mm-hmm, that's right." And before I realized what I was doing, I said, "No, that is not right." She said, "Mm-mm, that ain't right." It is not right that Jesus chastised Martha. Basically, what he said was, "He'll live again." She said, "I know he will in the last day." He was trying to tell her that he would live again now, and she was having a lot of trouble believing that. Then he got to Mary. She came out, said the exact same words, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." You think they talked about it? Saying the same thing. And I'll show you what the scripture says is God's reaction when you doubt him, when you're hurt, when you're angry. When you can't believe he did what he did by not stopping the tragedy and pain from your life, John chapter 11, verse 35. You remember it. What does it say? Jesus wept. He cries with us. Well, if he cries with us, then why in the world did he let it happen? Why did he let the pain come? Well, I've been trying to figure that out, as I said earlier, and I can't give you a definitive answer. I must say in the outset, much like God told Job. You recall in Job, when Job basically said the same thing, "I wish you would come down here and explain this to me," and God came. Remember that? And I'm paraphrasing, but Job basically said, "I didn't mean for you to come here." I mean, can you picture that? You're saying, "God, can you explain this to me?" What if a voice said, "You're looking for me?" And God told Job that when Job could be God, Not saying that Job ever would be, but if Job had the wisdom of God, if Job could hang the earth on nothing, if Job could put the stars in the sky, if Job could put the fish in the sea, then Job could understand it. You see, there are some things beyond our comprehension we just can't understand. And I'm about to tell you that the answers I'm going to give you are not the full and complete answer. I believe that as God told Job, some things are just beyond us, but I think at least I have some understanding as to why some of the things happen to us. One passage is in 1 Peter chapter 1. You probably are familiar with it already. For we exhorted to be faithful and to hang in there. And talking about this in verse 6, it says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." Now, the illustration pretty simple. What did he say? He said that faith gets tried by fire just like gold does. Now, you know that when they find gold out there in the rough, that it's never pure gold. It's always got ore mixed in with it. And what you do is you burn it. You burn it enough to get enough impurities out of it that you can do something with it. Now, you never do wind up with absolutely pure gold. You know that, don't you? And so they grade it like 10-karat gold, 14-karat gold, etc. Except back in this day and time, they didn't have that grading capability. And the illustration Peter uses is pretty neat. Now, I realize the danger in getting too much from an illustration, so I'm not going to belabor this too much. But I went to see a friend of mine, Herbert Ledbetter, who is the director of merchandise at the largest independently owned or privately owned jewelry company in America. They cover the entire Southeast, and he's a man who is a follower of Jesus. So I walked into his office one day and said, "Where's your Bible?" He opened his desk and pulled it out, and I said, "I need you to explain a passage to me." I turned to this and said, "Now, you are a goldsmith, right?" "Yes." "You are a gemologist, correct?" "Yes." "You know a lot about precious stones and metals?" "Yes, that's my training and that's what I do." He flies all over the world to buy these things. I said, "Explain to me the illustration. What's the Holy Spirit saying through Peter? You understand gold, I don't. What is it?" He said, "Well, you know, back in that day and time, an interesting thing occurred. Since they didn't have the grading, you know, the 10-carat, 14-carat, 24-carat, what would happen is that the goldsmith would keep passing the gold through the flame until enough of the impurities burn out that the goldsmith could see his reflection clearly in the gold. And when it reached that point, it was pure enough." Boy, there's an interesting illustration, isn't it? That what Peter was saying as illustration is that God lets bad things happen to us. Our faith is tried by fire. What's he doing? Well, he's bringing out the impurities. Why? Well, to see his reflection in you. So then I asked Herbert, I said, "Tell me more. Teach me." He said, "Well, there's another thing about gold." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "The more you put it through heat, the more malleable it becomes. That when it's being tried by fire, you can shape it into any shape that you want." I said, "So you read this and say that God's saying that when you guys are under pressure, when you're under pain, I have a better chance to shape you than any other way." He said, "Well, it's actually more intense than that." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You can't just heat gold once to get it to where you want it to be unless there's something relatively invaluable you're making from it. If you want it to become really precious and really worth a lot of money, then you heat it, shape it, let it gradually cool, because if you cool it too quickly, it becomes brittle. And when it gradually cools, then you heat it again, which makes it more malleable, which works, you work it more, let it gradually cool, and you keep going through that process until finally you wind up with something that is unbelievably precious. And not just that, but interestingly, much stronger than what you began with." Now, I don't know if God intended all those things in that one illustration, but that sure blew my mind. Thinking, wow, I know there are times when God has looked for his reflection in me and seen only me. Have you guys ever lived like that? That when God looks down, God doesn't see himself reflected in you. He sees your selfishness, your arrogance, your pride, your... Any sinners in the house? Sure he does. And so this shaping then begins to change me. It's making me stronger. And have you ever wished that God would teach you a lesson with no more pain? I'll ask the question to begin with. How many of you have been through some kind of tragedy, no matter what the tragedy may have been, and now you know on this side of it that you're much stronger than you were on the other side of it? You're much more spiritual than you were on the other side of it. You're much more godly, etc. How many of you, when you pray now, say, God, keep making me grow, keep making me like you, but don't hurt me no more? I pray that prayer too. Which part do you think God listens to? Can't listen to both. If he's got to burn the impurities out through the trials that he allows the devil to bring on me, then it's either you quit growing or I keep letting them hurt you. God himself does not inflict the pain, just like God did not personally inflict the pain on Job, right? The devil did that through his angelic forces. But at the end, in the last chapter, it talks about all the things that God did to him. Well, why did God do it? Or how did God do it? God did it by letting the devil do it. God could have stopped him at any time he so desired, but he didn't. You say, why didn't he? Well, he was thinking about you. Job could take it. Job had faith that became stronger and purer. God did have to get on him a little bit, but Job never left him. And if that had never happened in that situation, what strength would you be getting from that story today if it had never occurred? It did, and you learn. So the pain that comes to us is something that teaches us, that makes me purer, that makes me stronger, that makes me more precious. Dr. Lynn Anderson and I were sitting over coffee yesterday about lunchtime, talking about another person who's speaking on this program. Now, I'm not going to mention his name. Please don't think we were being malicious gossips. That's not what we were doing. We both have a lot of tremendous respect and love for this particular speaker and are unbelievably awed by the gift of speaking God has given him. Of course, at this point, you're thinking of whoever your favorite speaker is. And that's okay. Just kind of applied across the board. And Led said something that was absolutely profound. He said, can you imagine what effect he will have on audiences after his heart breaks? And I pictured it for a moment and I thought, oh, it will be awesome to see. Because when we want people to bless us spiritually, we need people whose hearts have broken. People who have been through the pain. People who have been shaped for something better. And it always requires that you have to hurt somehow to get to that point. There is no such thing without the pain. And when the pain comes, what do we beg for? We beg for deliverance. God, make it better right now. Why doesn't God make it better instantly? Well, if we use the gold illustration, and I realize I'm getting a little too strong with that, if you cool it too quickly, it becomes brittle. It's a gradual process of cooling and getting better. Now, you've experienced that kind of pain. You know what I'm talking about. And I'm quite convinced that sometimes then the pain that comes into my life because God wants me purer. God wants me stronger. Perhaps the best illustration I can give of that is something that happened when I was 5 years old. We lived on Gwinnett Street in Augusta, Georgia. Gwinnett Street's not there anymore. Now it's called something else, Laney Walker Boulevard. We lived in a house. They have a business there now called Fat Man's. No, I don't think there's any direct implication there, but when I was 5 years old, my younger brother, who was a year and a half younger than I, was three, of course, and we were out front playing in the tricycle. Our yard was 1 foot wide and about 4 feet long. We were playing in that with our tricycle. My younger brother, even though three and a half, was bigger than me at five and could always whip me, so it was always his turn to ride the tricycle. Might makes right. Understand that process? One day, he looked at me at rush hour time, about 4:30 in the afternoon, car zooming by. He looked at me and he said, you know what I'm going to do? I said, what? He said, I'm going to play motorcycle cop. I said, what does that mean? I want to stop those cars. I said, you're kidding. Nope. He turned and rode his tricycle into the street. Raised both hands and hollered, ho! And they did. Tires screeching, smoke swirling, people yelling things out a window to a 3.5-year-old he should never hear. I ran inside. Mother was washing dishes. I grabbed her skirt. Greg! Well, she'd heard the screeches when she heard Greg's name. She went into panic. She went running out, and there he sat, grinning from ear to ear. She grabbed Greg under one arm. She grabbed the tricycle under the other, walked into the yard, threw the tricycle down, sat down on the porch, and beat him. And when she finished, she said, if I catch you in that street again, I'll beat you harder. Do you understand? Next afternoon, about 4:30, Greg looked at me and he said, you know what I'm going to do? What? I'm going to blame motorcycle cop. You're kidding. Rode his tricycle into the street, both hands, oh! cars screeching, smoke swirling. Didn't have to be a good mother. She just knew. Came running out of the house. She grabbed Greg under one arm. She grabbed the tricycle under, walked into the yard, threw the tricycle down, and she beat him so hard. If I had been big enough to reach the phone, I would have called the Humane Society. She said, if I ever catch you in that street again, I'll beat you. You understand? Next afternoon, about 4:30. Greg and I went in the front yard. He said, you know what I'm going to do? And he did. Rode his tricycle in the street, hollered, ho, oh, here comes Mother. She threw the tricycle into the yard. She grabbed Greg. She brought him up there. She sat down. She looked at him, and I thought, when she finishes with him, she's going to kill me, too. She's that mad. We're all going to die. But she didn't whip him that day. She looked him in the eye, and she said, there's something you don't understand. You're 3.5 years old, and I'm not communicating this very well to you at all, and that's this. If you keep riding your tricycle into that street, a car is going to hit you and kill you. Now, while you can't understand that as a 3.5-year-old, what that means is, will I take your little body and put it in a little box and put it 6 feet down in the ground where it's cold and dark and damp? And I'll never be able to hold you again. And when I'm going to come stand at your bedroom door and watch you sleep and think of what you'll be when you become a man, you won't be there. When I want to stand at the back door and watch you play in the backyard and think about the wonderful future God's preparing for you, you won't be there. And when I just want to hear you talk, there won't be a voice. The reason I whip you is because I don't want you to die. And my brother Greg never played in the street again. By the way, now as an adult, he has a contracting company and he builds streets. Always was a weird little dude. Anyway, I think that's what God says. I'm going to let them whip you because I love you and I don't want you to die. And I'm trying to bring you to the senses because I don't want you to die. And so sometimes the pain that comes to my life comes because I need it. You know, anytime any bad thing happens to me, the first thing I stop and ask is this something I'm being punished for because I'm doing a good thing? Or is this God warning me to stop doing what I'm doing because it's a bad thing? It can be either. And so I stop, examine it, pray, look at it, make sure I'm being objective, ask a couple of people who I trust their counsel. And if I'm convinced that the devil's trying to stop a good thing, I keep on trucking. If the counsel of other godly people tell me, no, God's showing you, you need to do something differently, then I stop it. And everything that happens in my life, of any consequence, I stop and ask those questions about now. Sometimes, of course, though, God lets pain come into your life, not because you need it, but because somebody else needs it. I've used this illustration a lot. I used it at Memorial on Wednesday night. You remember Job in the Old Testament? Not Job, Joseph in the Old Testament? Have you heard of the Old Testament? Joseph was 17 years old when he wound up going into slavery. If he, at 17, was anything like 17-year-olds today, can you picture what that must have been like if God had come to him to talk to him about it before he sent him? Joseph, you have a mission for you. What? I'm going to make you the second most powerful man in the world, and you're going to save all of the civilization that we know from starvation. God, you picked the right dude. I can do it. Well, first I've got to train you a little. Okay, how long does it take? 2 weeks? Longer. 6 weeks? Longer. A year? Longer. What is this, God, like college? Sort of. Okay, 4 years. You're going to send me to Harvard. Maybe get an MBA, right? Well, a little beyond that. Well, what? Well, see, you're a sheep herder. Yeah. You got to know farming. You got to understand grain. Uh-huh. You're going to send me to farming school? Uh-huh. Where? Well, you're going to be a slave. And you're going to run a man's house and fields. And you're going to learn farming there. Slave? Uh-huh. But that won't be enough because then you got to understand government. And so I'm going to send you to prison because all politicians go there eventually. That was a joke, by the way. Not just any prison, but Pharaoh's prison. So he winds up in Pharaoh's prison, where the people that Pharaoh will capriciously put, remember the story of the butler and the baker? He capriciously puts people there, and so Joseph in prison begins to learn all the inner workings of the government, the good old know-who that gets things done behind the closed doors. Understand? And now at age 30, 13 years later, he comes out, he understands farming, he understands government, which was the harder part to learn, and now he is prepared to save the Egyptians from starvation, and by direct result, the Israelites from starvation, right? At age 17, if God had come to him and made that offer, and Joseph said, how long does it take? He says, 13 years. How long is 13 years to a 17-year-old? A lifetime. What do you think he would have said? You think he might have said something like, pick Reuben, Issachar, Judah, anybody but me, I don't want to go. I mean, I've got things, I'm a good-looking boy. I'll be wasted in that prison. God didn't ask, God just sent. I'm quite convinced, ladies and gentlemen, that some of you have endured pain or will endure pain because what God has in mind is not just your own strengthening. God is making you precious to others. And that you will be in a place to accomplish something that other people will not be able to accomplish, much like Esther. At a certain place for such a time as this, because God uses the devil against himself. The devil is not omniscient. He does not know. The rulers of this age would have never crucified Jesus if they had understood what they were doing. There's some pain that the devil would never bring into your life if he knew what God was going to do with it later. The devil enjoys hurting you through his forces. He wants to bring you pain, but he'd never bring that pain to help God's cause. And yet God keeps using him against himself, has, and still does. So that sometimes the pain you're going through is not a situation where God has abandoned you. It is actually a situation where God has chosen you. Of all the people on earth he could have picked, he picked you. Because he knew with a unique situation and balance of circumstances, talents, gifts, educability, and suffering, that you will be there for the right place at the right time to do the right thing. Some of you, through your pain, will be able to minister to folks that other folks will never even be able to understand, much less minister to you. It may be that you'll be ministering to one, it may be 100, it may be 1,000. It's the kind of thing that Paul talked about in 2 Corinthians 1 when he said we comfort others with the comfort with which we have been comforted. Do you understand? So when I see people in pain, my heart goes out to them because I hurt all over again. But I have a tinge of excitement. Wow, God must really have confidence in you. And what in the world do you think he's preparing you for? In the last 10 minutes of this, with your permission, I'm going to share a little of the story of my life so that you will understand why I believe this so strongly. I do this with some trepidation. I'm learning to be open. That's hard for me. But I'm learning how to share myself with others, and so if you'll let me try that again here. I've been trying to do it in more and more places because I need this. I need this. It helps me. At the same time, I think it can illustrate perfectly what I just have been telling you about, so that maybe when the next thing happens to you, or if you're going through something right now, you can begin to believe strongly that some good thing lies out there that God will use you for if you just don't let go. How many of you remember back about a decade ago when Rubel came out with that book about being just a Christian? Anybody remember that? Remember how warmly it was embraced by our entire fellowship? You don't know that ain't right. Some of us were asking questions back then that we thought were honorable questions to ask and questions that our fellowship could consider. It's amazing how that some people, when they hear questions, hear heresy instead. They think that if you question something, that means obviously you are not sound in the faith anymore. And I was one of those young preachers that had been allowed to be away from home quite a bit. I was booked 4 years in advance in speaking engagements, 66 days a year. I preached a series of sermons on non-denominational Christianity. I thought of all things that would not be controversial, surely that wouldn't. We claim to be non-denominational, do we not? Set off a brouhaha around the world, literally heard from people around the world. The mighty wonders of cassette tape. And wound up being canceled in every place I was booked for the next 4 years. Not only that, people were writing me letters, as many as four. Phone calls and letters were coming to Montgomery, Alabama, where I live today, saying, "You are lost. You are bad. You are evil." Somebody even wrote a fake letter to all the churches in the Montgomery area over a fake stationery they had designed themselves for the church where I was. They had made fake stationery for that church, signed my name to it. And I was crushed. I became impossible to live with. I became angry at everybody, including God. I've spent my life serving you. All I've ever done is tell what I believe to be true. I've never tried to hurt anybody, on purpose at least. Why are you letting this happen to me? The evil attack became so strong, I became impossible to live with, and finally my wife and I wound up not being able to live in the same house anymore. I moved to Montgomery, Alabama, and by that time I was so angry with God and so angry with you, meaning the churches of Christ at large, that I went into a lifestyle that has absolutely no justification. Oh, at the time it was totally rationalized. I could rationalize everything I did. Obviously it doesn't make any difference. God probably isn't even there. If he is, the Church of Christ sure can't be his church. Look how they act. All those kind of things, you know. So I did things I never thought I'd do, and I went places I never thought I'd go, and I said things I never thought I'd say. Things I wish I had never done. I tried to explain to my friend Jeff Walling one time how that God restores purity, but he can never restore innocence. You can never forget what you've done. You can never forget what you've learned how to do. I was sitting at a bar one night drinking. I'd never drunk before in my life, but you see, my business went bad. I went into a business I knew nothing about and failed at it miserably. The people I'd gone into business with saw a sucker coming and took full advantage of him. Within a period of a year, I lost $250,000. Now, all you preacher types, how much money do you have in the bank? So you know how much money I had in the bank, right? $250,000, I was overwhelmed. I began to apply for jobs. I'd go ask brothers, "Can you help me get a job at this place or that place?" "Sure, be glad to." It was only later I found out that those same brothers who said they were helping me would go back into these places and say, "Whatever you do, don't you hire this man, he's wicked." So I couldn't find a job because all my helpers weren't helping. So I wound up hungry. Sometimes as many as 3 days in a row with nothing to eat. And I'm sure that if I had gone to any church in Birmingham, Alabama, where I was then living, they would have fed me, but I was too proud and too mad. I discovered something I did not know. Nobody thinks to ask if you're hungry, but you can walk into the place where the lights are bright on the outside and dark on the inside. And if you can tell a joke, there are a lot of people who will buy you something to drink. Somebody asked me, "Joe, did you become an alcoholic?" It didn't last that long. I do remember sitting in one of those bars one night drinking, just wanting to get totally smashed. Tell another joke, get another drink. When some guy sat down next to me and he said, "Hey, you were the best preacher I ever heard." I did not get drunk that night. But I did the next. Denny Boltinghouse of Image Magazine did his best to try to help me. Rubel Shelley of Nashville, Tennessee, bought a plane ticket and flew to Birmingham looking for me, trying to save me. I would not listen to anybody. I then learned that you can get pills just the same way you can get the liquor. Just tell funnier jokes to the right people. And one night I fell into a heap full of alcohol and pills, and they took me to the emergency room, and they asked me if I knew any doctor, and I told them the name alone I could think of. He was an elder in the church there, and he came, and about midnight he was sitting in my intensive care room, and he said, "Joe, you are at L50. And I said, "What does L50 mean, Frank?" He said, 50% of the people with this much poison in their system die. You have a 1 in 2 chance of being alive in the morning. I watched them pull the code blue stuff for my impending heart attack just outside my room to get ready for resuscitation. A nurse stood by me all night. She held my hand. She wouldn't leave me. Never said a word. Just stood there all night long. Just about daylight, she said, "Did you mean to kill yourself?" "I don't think so." I thought, maybe I can talk. Maybe she'll listen. And I turned and looked at her and I said, you know, I used to be a preacher. She let go of my hand as if it was the filthiest thing she'd ever touched. She took 3 steps back, looked at me with this utter disgust, walked out of my room and refused to come back. They had to assign another nurse to take care of me for the rest of the time I was there. Obviously, I did not die. My younger brother from Beech Island, South Carolina, the one I told you about that rode the tricycle, came and stood outside my room for 3 days, and when he could, he took me back home. He gave me a job on his paving crew. I'd already spoken to over 1 million people around the country, and now I was shoveling asphalt because my younger brother's a very wise man. He knew what I needed to understand. He helped me find God again. And after I found God again, I called my wife and asked her if she would remarry me, and she said, under no circumstances. She asked all the Christian people she knew, should I take Joe back? And without exception, they all said no. God prevailed. We remarried. Denny Boltinghouse came and did of Image Magazine, came and did our wedding. And this summer, Alice and I have been remarried for 7 years. I made no bargains with God. There was no such thing as, God, I'll come back to you if you'll let me speak again. God, I'll come back to you if you invite me to go to churches again. I realized I had nothing with which to bargain, and so no bargain did I make. I'm a sinner. When the first church called, there's Clay Humphrey sitting over there. When Clay called and said, would you come speak for us? I was in utter shock. My first response was, no, I don't do that anymore. Clay pointed out to me, that speaking gift you have is not yours. God gave it to you. It's his. If he wants it, how can you tell him no? Well, I never had thought about it just like that. So with the encouragement of Clay Humphreys and people like that, I began to accept invitations again. And lo and behold, you wind up 7 years later and you're standing in front of 1,000 people and you look in your heart and you say, what am I doing here? I should be dead. God gave me my wife. God gave me my children. God gave me my life. And God prepared me to minister like I never ministered before, ever. I'm ashamed of what I've done, very much. But as I stand on this side of it, if God came and said, Joe, tell you what, I'm going to change history. I'm going to move you back to 1982. Just pick a day, any day, anywhere in 1982, and we're going to go back through all these years, and none of these bad things have happened to you. Not one's going to happen. I'd have to ask a question. God, in 1994, will I be like I am now? Loving you as much as I do now? Depending on you as strongly as I do now? Having the faith I do now? No, Joe. Have to have pain for that. You'll not have any of those things. Leave me here, God. I don't want to go back. I want to have what you gave me. My friends, I hope and pray that you know God will use you mightily no matter what you have done. No matter what has been done to you, no matter how much purification you've been through, if you trust Him. You're His, you know. He lets these things happen to use the devil against himself, and he'll use you for some ministry, and whatever it is, it will be important. Whatever it is. We've got some tapes on this kind of stuff. There's some yellow forms over there and yellow forms over there if you want them. I've got some some things here to subscribe to Image Magazine. I always talk about Image because of Denny Boltinghouse, my friend. If you'd like to subscribe, boy, there's some things up here. It's a great magazine to do that, too. This fellow right here, Dean Manning. If Dean will stand up right there, Dean. We're doing some seminars very similar to some of the things we talked about here very quickly. And if you want to be part of those seminars and talk to Dean, he's right here. And thank you very much for your time.